In this short retreat, we're looking at what is a Dharmachari. Yesterday, I talked quite a bit about the uniqueness of our ordination and what it means, really, to be a disciple. You know, that you really do have that common understanding with your preceptor, with the preceptors that ordain you, with the order members that agree to your ordination, and that goes back to Sangharakshita, who has, you know, this particular vision of ordination of the whole Dharma life. Because I think that's, you know, again, that's something that it rolls off the tongue, it trips off the tongue, but it's actually something I think worth going back to again and again. And I think we'll see as we go along, you know, how much that we sort of, in a sense, take for granted in the Dharma life has actually been really unfolded by Sangharakshita's vision. We haven't, as it were, made it up. You won't find it in every book you encounter on Buddhism. There is something really unique about it. And I mentioned that the first of the acceptance verses, sometimes called the ordination vows, which happened towards the end of the public ordination ceremony, which represent the whole sort of spirit with which ordination is given and received. And the first of these is, with loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination, with loyalty to my teachers. And I asked, when I first started to do public ordinations, I was very intrigued by these four acceptance verses. You know, when you actually do a ceremony, you see the ceremony in quite a different light than when you've undergone it. You have to kind of understand it more deeply. And I don't think anybody had really asked Bhante about these four acceptance verses. And they were verses that he'd composed himself. So we were walking down the road towards the ferry, and I was asking about the verses, and he said yes, he'd written them. And he said they just came to him. They weren't anything he particularly thought about. They just came. And I said, well, what about this with loyalty to my teachers? And he said, well, first of all, it's good that I put teachers in the plural, isn't it? Because we now have a public preceptor and a private preceptor. Ideally, you'd have a different private preceptor from a public preceptor. And he said he thought that, you know, it was quite good that he'd somehow intuited that it's teachers plural. But of course there are other teachers, other Kalyana Mitras that we have that we're loyal to. And I asked him about the word loyalty, and he said a very interesting thing. He said, you notice loyalty to, not faith in. Loyalty to, not faith in. And as often happens when I have had conversations with Bhante, it didn't occur to me to say, well, what's the significance of that difference? And I was, oh yeah, right, you know, as if I know. And I think, oh, you know, another opportunity missed, a bit sort of dim in that way. But I reflected on it, and I think what he meant was that faith, Shraddha, is for the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. Shraddha is that resonance with the transcendental. You're not seeing your teacher as the Buddha. You're not seeing your teacher as the Dharma and the Sangha in the sort of transcendental sense, although it might be, it could be, that your teacher has some connection with that. It's possible. But, I mean, in a way, that's very hard for you to determine. I find it very interesting with Sangharakshita. He's definitely my teacher. I have absolutely no idea or even interest in what level of attainment he's reached, which is quite interesting. I do not know if he's a stream entrant, an irreversible bodhisattva, and I don't care. It really doesn't interest me, the cash value of his attainment, if you like. That seems very, very superficial and in a way quite vulgar to even inquire into. I know that he's affected my life very, very powerfully. I have a sense when I'm with him of something mysterious that I can't get hold of. And I've had an experience. I've known him since I was 17, since 1974. And I've had the experience of him, of unfailing kindness and consideration, as well as, you know, considerable wisdom, you know, in terms of, you know, his impact on my life and other people's life. I've seen him in all sorts of situations. I've seen him in Britain, I've seen him here, I've seen him in India. I've lived closely with him in India, you know, for a couple of weeks. And in all that, I've never ever doubted that, that Sangharakshita is my teacher, even though I've had some quite difficult times with him. But looking back, the difficult times were very important times. But I have no idea or any interest in where he is in the sort of cosmic scheme of things in terms of attainment. As I say, I find that a rather kind of vulgar kind of pastime when people are trying to calibrate levels of attainment, and seems to be not really the point. I think that when one's in the Dharmacharya, when one's really in the life of the Dharma, you don't need to think about that. You don't need to worry about that. You just need to concentrate on the life, on fully living the life of the Dharma as intensively and as fully as you can. And really, you know, just get into the quality of that now, right now. So, not faith in, loyalty to. Faith is for the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You know, I find it very interesting that Sangharakshita himself has this very deep but quiet devotion, very unostentatious devotion to the Buddha. I can remember one occasion when it was that time in the movement, one of those fashions that swept the movement at one time, which seemed to periodically blow through. It was when Buddha nature was kind of all the rage in some circles, you know, that in some way you're enlightened, fully, completely enlightened already, and you just have to sort of wake up to it in the moment and all that sort of thing. And we were asking Sangharakshita about that. It was one of the ordination courses. He came for a meal and people had questions. So there was a question about Buddha nature. And Bhante said, well, certainly in the sense of potentiality, that we have the potential to become a Buddha. We have that potential. Yes, he said, I do really, you know, I don't know if he used the word belief, but he said, yes, I do believe that. I do feel that. He said, but the idea that you are right now a fully and perfectly enlightened Buddha, with all the powers, all the qualities, all the virtues, and he kind of listed them through. He said, "Oh," he said, "I really don't think it's like that." And as he talked, what came over was his sense of devotion and reverence for the Buddha. You know, he wasn't going to abrogate to himself Buddhahood. It was more a matter of the way you feel Buddhahood is that you bow your head in reverence to the immensity of the Buddha. And of course that's how you begin to move in that direction. So I suppose I've experienced Sangharakshita's faith in the Buddha, his faith in the Dharma, his faith in the Sangha. So what did he mean by loyalty to? He said, I mean loyalty in the medieval feudal sense. And I went, yeah, right, you know. He'd mean, and I, so I looked it up. It's quite, you know, and what he, I think what he really meant was the, in the sense of the strength of the word loyal. You know, this very, very, very strong sense of a bond with your teacher. He doesn't mean by that blind loyalty. He doesn't mean by that subservience. He doesn't mean by obedience. It's the strength of the connection that he's really getting at. And I think that that also betrays his, or reveals his sense of what ordination really is. And the strength of what goes on at ordination, of what it really means to him. The word for ordination in Pali and Sanskrit is sangvara. sangvara, which literally means a binding. It's a very strong word. You're bound, you're vowed to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. You're bound, you're vowed to your 10 precepts, your shikshapadas, your pratimoksha, your rules of training, your basic ethical code. That's very, very strong for you. You don't want to be apart from that. I'm going to tell you something which might upset some of you, might be quite controversial. I remember years and years ago Sangharakshita saying that if people really took ordination seriously, they couldn't possibly undergo another big life-changing commitment like marriage. And some people are horrified that, what's it? You know, why is he saying this? Marriage, blah, blah, blah. But what he means, what he's actually revealing is his vision of ordination. That this is a really solemn, serious commitment. You know, that he's taking all of you. You know, it's okay if you're married beforehand, fair enough. You know, you know, but if you're single and you get ordained, how can you add to that? How could you undergo another sort of solemn, serious sort of ceremony? This is, you know, this is the point he was making, the sort of depth of the ordination. So loyalty, a binding, and so on. Loyalty to our teachers, to our tradition. And this can really kind of underpins, if you like, the Dharmacharya. Just to say, I don't think I really said what Dharmacharya means. Charya means somebody who's a chari. It comes from the word charity, which means to fare, to walk, to practice. So it's somebody who fares in, who practices, who walks in, who lives the Dharma. That's what a Dharmachari is. Walking and faring and living the Dharma. Konza translates Charya as coursing. If you ever read Konza's translations of The Perfection of Wisdom, he talks about coursing in the deep course of the wisdom that has gone beyond. Coursing in the profound wisdom. It's the same word, Charya. It's actually used a lot to describe the different kinds of life that go on in the Dharma life. There's Bodhicharya, or Bodhisattvacharya, the Bodhisattva's life. There's Bhadracharya, which is another way of describing the Bodhisattva's life. There's, of course, Brahmacharya, which is describing celibacy in the higher life. There's Anubhogacharya, the life of supreme enjoyment, which opens up to you at a certain point in your spiritual life. I think we all could do with a bit of that. And so on and so forth. So lots of charyas. And it's very interesting that this term is used in the Dharma so much. It's making it clear that the Dharma life is not about having experiences. It's not about having insights. It's not about just having a lot of knowledge in your head or something like that. It's not something that you do part-time. It's a life, a living. You're living in the Dharma. You're living for the Dharma. The Dharma's within you. You are within it. You are coming together with other Dharmacharis. I'm going to labour this point ad nauseam this week, because I think that there is a sort of tendency, and I think it's partly to do with the state of the world and partly to do with the nature of technology, wonderful though it is, of an increasingly ideas-driven approach to Dharma, which actually doesn't work. People thinking that they can have a sort of Dharma life on their computer screens, having lots of sort of interaction with somebody far away on another computer terminal, on another screen, and just living their own life very privately, a bit of meditation, maybe even a lot of meditation, but no real living. No real living. And living means interacting with others. Life means coming together with others. Human beings come together. There's an increasing sort of atomization. And I go even further. I think, from what I can see, Buddhism in the West seems to attract quite a lot of introverts. I'm one of the discriminated against extroverts in the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. I'm thinking of starting an extroverts support group because I feel so victimised by it. That's a joke. But I think that that's something to... What? What's that? Surita just gave me... Surita just gave me a stern look. He's an introvert and a very good friend.
And I love him. Introvert.
What?
Extroverted introvert.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know what that means. But anyway, but it's something to really watch, that we don't try to sort of turn the Dharma life into something very private and introverted. You know, maybe images of the Buddha that have come to us, and the whole sort of vision of the Buddha meditating, being very peaceful in the forest and so on, which, you know, it's a wonderful image, and you know, we could all do with lots of that. But the Buddha walked. The Buddha spent a lot of his time walking. Charya. That's probably where this word comes from, because the bhikkhus walked, the wanderers walked. That's how they lived. They went from place to place. That was part of their practice, part of their life. Being homeless, you know, travelling around, you know, really no home at all. You know, just staying put in the reins for a few months of retreat, but going about. And not only that, the Buddha goes about to communicate the Dharma, to create spiritual community, to create Sangha, you know, to communicate the Dharma to people so that it's a way to liberation. But there's absolutely no doubt that the Buddha wanted to create and did create a harmonious spiritual community. Sometimes people, I've even heard some order members, you know, question the whole language of creating Sangha, as if it's sort of not something central, you know, to Buddhist life, that it's something, they even quote the Buddha, going forth alone. Of course he did. But, you know, the Buddha comes out of a whole tradition of community. You know, there's that incredible incident after his enlightenment where he says, it is painful, it is dukkha, for a man not to revere and rely on and place himself under another man. It's extraordinary, an enlightened being, recognising the pain of not being able to look up to another, not being able to be living in dependence upon another. What he's saying is it's painful not to be a disciple. It's painful not to be part of a community of disciples under a teacher. And he looks around. He can't find anybody actually who is higher than him. So he decides to revere and rely upon the Dharma. That will be his sort of, as it were, his guide, if you can talk about a guide for an enlightened one. I mean, Bhante's explored this in a couple of places, this particular incident. But one of the ways, of course, he reveres and relies on the Dharma is by communicating it to everybody and creating a spiritual community out of that. And that's one of the things that, of course, that we're doing within our own order. The second of the acceptance verses goes, in harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. In harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. I mean, that's actually the atmosphere at an ordination. Just say that. An extremely harmonious and positive event, joyous event when there's public ordination. I've done them in a number of contexts. I've done them here with family and friends at centres, with family and friends. I've done them at Kukiloka. And people are so happy. People are so happy, so pleased. Even non-Buddhists, if they're there, are so joyous at witnessing somebody entering into the Dharma life. When I first did public ordination, the very first one I did in here, I was very, very struck by the non-Buddhist friends of the person being ordained. And I realised they were seeing the fourth sight. They weren't seeing somebody who was becoming a monk. This was a married man, a grandfather actually. He was getting on a bit at the time. And they were so touched, seeing this man formally enter into the Dharma life. And even though they weren't having that life themselves, they could feel it. And there was this tremendous goodwill and harmony and love and metta in the atmosphere and joy. I think people really do love to see that. I think there's probably something in a healthy human being, if they see somebody living a life, really living a life, they're very moved by that. And yes, there's a harmony in the ordination ceremony, but it isn't just about the ordination ceremony. One of the things that we do as Dharmacharis is really work for harmony. Really, really work for harmony in the Dharma life. Really work for harmony within the spiritual community itself, and work for harmony in the world. It's one of those words, harmony, that's overused. Harmony, everybody getting on well, and so on. And it can be very easy to get into, sort of platitudes about, living in harmony. And I really want to avoid that, because I think real harmony, even unity, it's another word that the Buddha uses, between people, is very hard won. Very, very hard won. I can remember, I used to go to inter-religious meetings in India and also in this country. There'd be a lot of talk about, harmony and unity and, tolerance and all that sort of thing. But I always felt that it was really quite empty. It was just platitudes. It was making everybody feel good. And it was good that we all came together, but it didn't really have depth. Harmony in a piece of music, it's not everybody playing the same note and pretending that they're all the same. In a really great piece of music, the harmonies are hard won. And you have to go through all sorts of dissonances and, all sorts of, vibrations and clashes in order to achieve the really, really deep, harmony, that's really pleasing and uplifting. You can't just sort of, when you have a superficial piece of music where you've got a sort of cheap harmony, it just doesn't mean anything, it doesn't do anything to you. So yes, harmony. It's actually, in the end, I think, a very profound thing, that you could even see the whole of the Dharma life, the Buddhist life, Buddhist practice, even gaining enlightenment itself, as the attainment of harmony, of unity, even. In our, we make place a lot of emphasis on friendship and community and harmony and concord and metta, loving kindness between each other and all that sort of thing. And, it's worth reflecting, well, where does that come from? Where does that emphasis come from? You think, well, it comes from us, because we're all like that, and to some extent it does. But as an idea, as a practice, as a vision, where does it come from? I think sometimes people think it's sort of incidental, almost just sort of bit luck, really, that we make that emphasis. I remember talking to a friend in Leeds about a mutual friend of us who has come and gone in our movement quite a few times and is exploring other communities, religious communities, spiritual communities. And I said, well, how's he getting on? Because I think we're all very fond of him. And he said, well, when I meet up with him, he's doing okay, but he says what he really misses is Sangha. What he really misses is friendship. That's something that, is so strong in our community, even though we know it's not perfect. And there's a lot of work to do on it. But I was reflecting, I've heard this more than once, people involved in other traditions, but where does it come from? It's not a mistake, it's not an accident. It comes from Sangharakshita's vision again. There's another, it comes from our teacher. His vision of Sangha, of friendship, is intrinsic to his vision of enlightenment. There's a very, very important lecture called A Case of Dysentery, which I'd recommend listening to, not just reading it in the book, The Buddha's Victory, where he's talking about, it's the story of the sick monk who's neglected by the fellow monks. And he's talking about, why does the Buddha have Ananda as an attendant, as a companion, as a friend? And it's quite obvious that, that Ananda is a friend. You know, Bhante points out at the end of the Buddha's life, when they Ananda reflects on that the Buddha is dying, he said, "He who is so kind to me is about to pass away, my teacher." And the Buddha, when he rejoices, he first of all encourages Ananda, then he rejoices in Ananda in the most fulsome way, describing Ananda's continual acts of kindness towards him in body, speech and mind, in private and in public loving kindness that is ease giving, lovely phrase, ease giving, undivided, without distraction. And Bhante just pointed out, he said, well, when two people describe each other as kind to each other, you have to call that a friendship. You know, it's nothing other than a friendship. Friendship, in this case, of a very high order. So he says that there's an element of friendship in enlightenment. Enlightenment is not one-sided. There's a lot of emphasis in the Buddhist world on the Buddha's wisdom and insight. There's a lot of emphasis on the Buddha's compassion, but we don't often hear about the Buddha as a friend, and that the Buddha practiced friendship. It's not just, and compassion can have the sort of sense, love and compassion can have the sort of sense that, of coming down from on high and doing something to people and then going away. The Buddha didn't just do that, he got into communication with people. There's a reciprocal element to the love, to the friendship, certainly in Ananda's case, well, in the case of all the great disciples, there's a flow. Sangha actually said this is related to that very mysterious concept of Mahayana Buddhism, the Sambhogakaya. The Sambhogakaya. In Mahayana Buddhism, certain schools of Mahayana Buddhism, they say that the Buddha has three kayas, three dimensions. Kaya is literally body, but it's probably better to think of them as dimensions, depths, if you like. And one of these is the Sambhogakaya, which literally translates as the body of mutual enjoyment or mutual delight. There's a dimension of the Buddha, a dimension of enlightenment, that is constantly delighting in the enlightenment, or even you could say the emerging enlightenment in others. And there's something that's being delighted in by those others. I think it's a brilliant insight of Bhante's, you know, that friendship is not an added extra, it's part of the nature of reality, you could even say. So that's why there's so much emphasis on spiritual community. This isn't just encouraging a sort of sociability or a sort of gregariousness, or, you know, we're trying to create a sort of a cocktail party circuit, if you like, of Buddhists, you know, and, you know, it's not sort of sociability. Sangha actually is not a particularly gregarious, social kind of person in a certain sort of way. He's quite a private man, but he has this deep, deep, in a sense, faith in human communication. And his insight into communication, we use this word communication, it trips off the tongue, but I said, I think, yesterday that by communication he means a vital mutual responsiveness, a common exploration of the spiritual world in complete harmony and complete honesty. And that's what he says is going for refuge to the Sangha. It's this deep, deep communication. We're trying to meet on the deepest possible level. And when you meet on the deepest possible level, you really are in deep harmony. If you like, subject and object, self and other, begins to dissolve away. You have this mysterious experience of being deeply, in a sense, yourself. That's such a superficial way of putting it, your sense of your uniqueness. But you have but you're in perfect harmony with the uniqueness of everybody else. That's what we're trying to create within a spiritual community. That's what we're trying to offer the world. That's what we're trying to give to people. But the question arises, how do we do it? How do we actually work for it? I'm very conscious in talking about this. One can be very inspired, very inspirational about all this stuff. But actually, it's the hard yards of life, of practice, of communication and friendship with one another, that where the real you know, where the real teaching is, in a sense. So I want to talk about a teaching of the Buddha's, the six memorable qualities that conduce to love and respect within the Sangha, that bring about concord, one-heartedness, that bring about harmony and non-dispute. And these six qualities the Buddha gave to the bhikkhus at Kasambi. This is a sort of celebrated case within the Pali texts of serious disharmony and dispute within the Bhikshu Sangha, which is kind of reassuring in a way, that there was dispute among the disciples of the Buddha. And we can tend to think, well, if we were around the Buddha, everything would be fine. If we were with those enlightened guys, we would all be in harmony and everything would be fine. We wouldn't have all the sort of difficulties and struggles that we have now. But it wasn't like that. In fact, the story is quite interesting over the dispute at Kasambi, the quarrel at Kasambi. It was a very serious one among a number of bhikkhus. There was a falling out over a water pot used in the latrine. I can't remember the details, but where it was left and whether it was empty. And this caused a massive row between two factions, followers of different senior bhikkhus within the Sangha. And I would imagine it was one of those things where even the original dispute was probably forgotten. And it was probably, but by the look of it, when you look at the sutta, it was one of those things, this is just an excuse for a verbal punch-up. Maybe even, I think it even came to physical blows, you know. You imagine it, you know, the bhikkhus actually really getting stuck in with each other. And it was obviously a very serious dispute because different senior disciples of the Buddha went to mediate. It didn't work. Eventually, the Buddha had to kind of go in. Now, the Buddha comes and he says, the first thing he says is, bhikkhus, stop. Stop hurting each other with verbal daggers. Just stop. With verbal daggers, verbal arrows. Just stop it. That's all he says. Stop. And a bhikkhu comes along, and this is incredible, comes along to the Buddha and says, Bhante, Bhagwan, Lord, leave it to us. You don't worry. You be comfortable. Everything's fine. And it was clearly something really, you know, really patronizing to the Buddha. And the Buddha, his response was, these people do not even want to be in harmony. And he goes off into the jungle, into retreat. He can't do anything for them. Goes off into retreat. He eventually comes across the three monks living in the Kasinga Sal wood, who are living like milk and water blended in perfect harmony. That wonderful sutta, the Kasinga, the Chula Kasinga Sutta. But what's interesting about it, the Buddha can't sort them out. They don't, you know, we all identify with the Buddha and the good disciples. We don't identify with the Kasambia monks. We think, oh, those stupid people. If I was there with the Buddha, I wouldn't be like that. But it's not actually like that. You know, I've been in situations where even Bhante hasn't been able to bring around about harmony between order members. You know, it hasn't sort of worked. If you don't want to be in harmony, nothing's going to bring it about for you. No external agent is going to do it. No amount of mediation will bring about. Something's got to change within you. What's really telling about the Kasambi monks is that eventually it was the laity who basically went on strike. They were so disgusted by what they'd seen. They said, right, no more food, no more robes, no more medicines. And immediately there was harmony. Really interesting, not the Buddha, but their stomachs, their shelter, their health, that restored harmony. The Buddha gives six memorable qualities for bringing about harmony within the Sangha. So it's a practice, and like I say, it was something the Buddha was very, very concerned about. You know, with those monks in the Kasinga Sal wood, his first question, bhikkhus, are you living in harmony? Are you looking at each other with the eye of affection, the eye of love, the priya chaku, priya chakshu? Are you in harmony like milk and water blended? That was his first question. Then, and when they said yes, he said, how do you do it? How do you bring this about? And they described their practice. And in that case, the first thing they talk about is gratitude. How grateful they are to be with each other, to have friends that they practice with. That's the first thing. They reflect on the great boon of being with what's known as the Sabrahmacharya, the fellow Brahmafarers, the fellows in the higher life. And they go on like this, describing the different things that they do and how they meditate, how they study regularly together, and you know the way they clear up for each other. They don't have to kind of have a rota about things. They just constantly have this awareness out there for the other. It's wonderful, and it goes on describing how actually they're enlightened. But one of the wonderful phrases in that is, we have three bodies, Bhagavan, but assuredly we only have one mind, one heart, ekachitta. Three bodies but one heart, because of this constant loving kindness in actual deeds, in actual behaviour. An extraordinary, you know, description of a spiritual community. Three bodies, one heart, one mind. It doesn't mean, you know, that they are kind of all, you know, they're one in a sort of automaton sense. It's not saying that. It's just this very, very powerful point to talk about the degree of harmony they have for one another, transparency, you know, for one another. So let's look at the six memorable, you know, qualities. So I think they do repay some reflection, study, meditation, and actual practice with one another. So the first three are love, in the sense of metta. Metta in the form of bodily deeds, metta in the form of vocal deeds, and metta in the form of mental deeds. Metta in body, speech, and mind. This is really important, that your deeds are of body and speech and mind. They're all action. This is something that we really underestimate, especially with mind and speech. But it's all action. It's all karmic. It's all willed action. It's all going to have an effect and an impact. It's the doing of loving kindness, not waiting for loving kindness to sort of arise as a wonderful feeling, but actions of love. You behave as if you have loving kindness. Loving kindness is something you actually develop and do out of consideration for others. So the first is in body. You do things in private and public, whether the person is present or not, for your fellows in the Dharma life. Well, this means that you actually have to be with them. In another place, in towards the end of the Buddha's life, where he gives the teaching on the conditions for the long life of the Sangha, he says the first condition for that is, so long as the bhikkhus, the brethren, the Sangha, meet together repeatedly and in large numbers, that long you can expect their development and not their decline. So it's the obvious place. Before you can talk about being in harmony, you have to get together. You actually have to be with each other physically. You have to be in the same place, in the same room, in the same building. You need to be meeting up in this actual public reality. You know, it seems so obvious. Why did we say it? But I say it's obvious, but I think it is something that gets forgotten. And again, especially with, you know, the reliance people can have on, you know, computer screens, emails, blogs, and discussion groups. You're not actually with people. They're not there. Even when you're Skyping, they're not there. You actually have to be with people. So in terms of the Dharmacharya's life, in a life of an order member, this means regularly meeting up with other order members. So that could be in terms of personal friendship, personal communication. There's also the regular weekly order chapter meeting. Men of Ask for Ordination have their regular weekly Going for Refuge group as a sort of preparation for that. But the regular weekly chapter meeting, you're there for one another, you know, to really help each other in your Dharma life in complete harmony and complete honesty. That's what you're doing in a chapter meeting, in a Going for Refuge group. It's there to deepen your engagement with the Dharma. But there you are, in the same room with one another. Within the order as well, we have regular big order weekends, regional, national order weekends. There are order retreats. There are order conventions every, you know, few years. So ways in which people come together, actually meet and get together. If you can, if it's possible, live with other Dharmacharis. Live with people who are in the Dharma life. It's not, you know, possible for everybody because they have other responsibilities. But in one way or another, you're doing everything you can to get together with fellow Dharmacharis, with those living the Dharma life. It might be, as well, that you, a very important way of getting together is working together for the Dharma. Working together for the Dharma, to bring about the Dharma, the development of the Dharma in the world. Sometimes it's hard to get together with order members. They can be, you know, very busy with all sorts of things, you know, presumably, you know, working for the Dharma. One hopes so. Well, get together with them. Help them. How can I help? What can I do? How can I help you in your work? The getting together isn't just simply sitting over a cup of tea talking about, you know, your internals. It's much better to get together and do things together. You can also enjoy each other's company together as well. Get together to do, you know, really fun things, skillful things. One of the things it said that a bodhisattva does, one of his main practices, is to gather a community. You know, to get people together, to do the Dharma work, to bring them together in all sorts of ways. One of the ways it said that he gets them together to, you know, to, you know, for skillful, positive celebration, you know, particularly festivals, that sort of thing. But in whatever way you come together, you actually meet and you do things together to deepen your Dharmacharya. You can't have harmony, you can't build harmony and create harmony without actually meeting. And you maximise that as much as you possibly can. Then there's speech. Obviously, when you meet, you really aim to be as not just as truthful as you can be, but as kindly as you can be, as helpful as you can be, in the way you communicate, in the way you speak, but also in the way you listen. You know, you really do listen. If you want that vital mutual responsiveness, that's also to do with how you listen, how you hear the other person. Speech is such a big area for speech precepts for us. And I think the emphasis, if you like, perhaps we can just mention two things to bring about harmony, greater harmony. One is confession. Confession, complete honesty about yourself. You know, in terms of your Dharma life with your spiritual friends, really opening up to them, not getting into blaming them and for their faults, but really looking at your own part in things. It's very interesting. There are some suttas where the Buddha talks about how to heal disputes within the Sangha. I don't think we've really looked at them sufficiently. And in one of these, he talks about the first thing you have to do if there's a dispute is to put straw on the mud. Straw on the mud. Very, you know, the Buddha, you know, he lived in a society where, you know, people would know what it would mean to put straw on the mud. So there's a lot of mud, isn't there, when there's disharmony and disputes between people. And when people enter that mud, they get stuck, they slip over, they get hurt. You know, when there's a dispute, well, to change the metaphor, it's the classic Gordian knot, isn't it? That you you know, well, he said, you said, I've said, no said, etc., etc. Put straw on it. And what's putting straw on it? confession. You look into yourself, you confess your faults, whatever they are. You forget, in other words, you put aside any blame of the other. You put aside their fault. You just confess. There's mutual confession. Mutual opening up to one another within the Sangha. Not easy. Quite complicated, because we have a lot of conceit, a lot of pride, especially if we feel we've been hurt or hard done by. I think pride and conceit is a much bigger issue than we care to admit. Very often in the West, we dwell on how much we, you know, have a bad view of ourselves, and, you know, all the rest of it. And, you know, I have a low self-esteem. I don't love myself. And that can be a mighty cop-out for actually not acknowledging our absolutely outrageous conceit. I speak personally. A lot of pride and conceit. A lot of view about myself, whether higher, lower, equal to. I think that Westerners don't often acknowledge the conceit that they have. And one of the things that confession does, I think, when you're really honest about yourself, you know, within the context of creating harmony, is that it's a wonderful sort of leveller in the positive sense. It creates this sort of parity, this sameness, you know, between people. The straw is on the mud. Then you can walk in on the straw and actually have a proper meeting when you do that. So there's confession, and there's also rejoicing. Really rejoicing, really looking for the qualities in your fellows in the Dharma life. In the Dharma living, really, really meditating on them in your meditation, in your metta bhavana, really searching for the qualities of your friends, you know, really finding them, trying to get yourself out the way to really celebrate that person, really see the way in which their Dharma potential is manifesting, and saying it, celebrating it. I remember when Subhuti gave some talks about spiritual friendship, and he was talking about the duties of speech and spiritual friendship. He was saying that if you have a really good friend, if you have really good friends, your speech becomes like Manjugosha. It becomes the sweet voice, the sweet speech, the soft voice. It becomes poetry, whether or not you're a poet. You know, if you really dwell, really look at the qualities in your friends, you become a poet. You know, your love for that person will turn into poetry as you speak. And of course we need that so much. You know, when there's, I mean, real rejoicing, not saying, oh, he's a lovely bloke. You know, it's really not good enough. Actually naming the quality, it's such a gift, because sometimes people don't know their qualities. They really don't know their qualities, because their qualities are with them all the time. And they don't know that they're doing really good things. They actually don't know that. So if you notice a quality, say it. Tell it. Make it known. Because it becomes a great source of strength, you know, for that person. And it brings you closer. I think the pillar for kindly speech, I think it's kindly speech in the 10 pillars, it's the pillar of amber. An amber pillar. Because amber, when it's rubbed, It attracts bodies to it. Lovely. And that really seems to go with Manjigosha, doesn't it? And then mind. Loving kindness in mind is the way you bring about harmony. So constant metta bhavana towards your fellows in the Dharma life. Constant metta bhavana practice. Metta should be a daily practice. I think it's such an important meditation. Okay, maybe it's your mindfulness of breathing day, that day, but do some metta at the end. You know, and bring to mind your fellows in the Dharma life and love them. Really cultivate love to them. We have a practice in the order every month at 4:30 or 5 o'clock on the first Saturday of the month throughout the world. All order members do the order metta bhavana. They all do metta for one another, all over. And it's a really, really good practice. I remember when I first did it, it was so strong, so powerful, especially when I was living in India. And at that time, it was, I think, the first Sunday of every month, and it was 7 o'clock GMT, which meant Lokamitra and I had to get up at midnight to do the Order Metta, and we did it religiously. We felt so alone in India doing the Dharma work at that time. We got up to do our Order Metta Bhavana because we wanted to feel that the Order was with us, and we wanted to have that kind of presence, you know, with us. So work on the mind, you know, and especially if there's disharmony, put that person in the fourth stage. Really, really work at it. It does do something. So the mental practice of metta, metta citta, the mind of loving kindness, acts of mind, very, very powerful. And the order metta as a practice came out of Bhante being on a solitary retreat in a chalet on a clifftop in Cornwall. He'd gone off, I think, for a year's sabbatical. And he had a vivid sense of the order being present, even though he was there with just one other person. He'd sit down, we'd just be there, sitting there, and have a very, very strong sense of the order. And I think it was around this time he started to speak of the order as being, or being symbolised by, or a reflection of the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. This extraordinary image of Mahakarunika, the greatly compassionate one, enlightened compassion, which is kind of one that has all these, you know, all these different hands with different implements. So it's describing a consciousness which is fully unified and harmonized, but is reaching out in very particular ways to meet people. So it's that image of sort of oneness and particularity. That's his vision for the order. That's what we're trying to do in the order. Very, very strong. But we have to work at it. We have to work at it. And it's not something you can just invoke, you know, when there are difficulties. Sometimes you've got to honestly engage, you know, with the difficulties. And that's not easy. You've got to put the straw on the mud, as I said. The next thing, in a way, I've already mentioned. It's the fourth memorable quality is a shared life, a common life. And of course, the bhikkhus had everything in common. They're paupers. They've given up everything, and all they've got is a robe, or three robes, a begging bowl, needle and thread, and everything is held in common, even down to the contents of the begging bowl. The Buddha says there's this tremendous sense of sharing. You know, if you really, you know, the Buddha and his disciples are the true eco warriors, I should say. If you're serious about the environment, live a communal life, live a common life, and have everything in common, and live simply, be a renunciate. That's what the Buddha and his disciples were. Tall order for us. But yes, this common life. And I think for us, you know, some of us do live a shared life in communities. But it still applies. We have to have this sense, you know, whatever our circumstances, that we're sharing the Dharma life together, and particularly working for the Dharma together, to bring it out to, you know, to take the Dharma out to the world. Perhaps that's something you can, you know, ponder a bit, this common life, this shared life, and what that might mean to you, especially, you know, if you don't live in communities and things like that. How can you experience that? Because it is a very important condition for harmony, you know, within the Sangha. The next, the fifth, is a common ethical code. Having the same precepts. You know, you share the same ethics, which you practice with purity. You really aim to be as ethical as you possibly can. Well, within the order, we share the 10 precepts. That's our fundamental ethical code. So it's really important that when we meet and when we discuss, you know, within the order, even before we ordained, we're doing it on the basis of a shared ethical life, a shared training, because our 10 precepts actually cover the whole of the Dharma life. So that means we've all got to really understand the meaning of our precepts and our common training. You know, particularly study that 10 pillars of Buddhism, you know, very, very deeply. and making sure that when we discuss things, you know, particularly within our own individual life, you know, within our shared life within the spiritual community, we're doing it on the basis of the common ethical ideal. We're not importing other ways of looking at things which really don't have anything to do with the Dharma, that are based on other assumptions, you know, maybe very worldly assumptions to do with psychology or sociology or politics. Are we looking at things ethically? Are we really understanding the path that we're following? And this brings us to the last of the memorable qualities, and this is view or vision. The word is ditti. The Buddha says that if you want harmony within the spiritual community, within the Sangha, you have to all have a shared view or vision of things. And actually, he says this is the superior quality. This quality makes sense of them all. There's a common vision. There's a common view. In the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, in his discussion of right view, he says very, very strongly that one of the things we need to do is to really get to grips with our wrong views, our false views that we've been exposed to since childhood and which go on. The views pour out of the radio, they pour out of the internet, they pour out of the television. They infect our books in one way or another, the books that we read, and we often don't know it. You know, you see it sometimes when a very cherished opinion, unanalyzed opinion, that you've taken up is challenged. You know, innocently challenged. Suddenly, you're getting all hot under the collar. Hey, that's a view. You know, and you might even assume it's a dharmic view. You might even assume it is the way things are, but actually the Dharma contradicts it. This is a really interesting one, you know, and it gets very, very challenging. So we need to look at our false views, and you only really do that by developing right view, and that means studying deeply the Buddha's teaching, particularly as it's communicated through our teacher and his disciples. We really get to grips with right view. We really study the basic doctrines of Buddhism. In his interview, What is the Western Buddhist Order?, Bhante goes through our basic doctrine. Yeah, it's Pratichasamutpada, Shunyata, Four Noble Truths, the Three Lakshanas. You know, he goes right through it. Spiral conditionality, cyclic conditionality. Well, you've really got to ponder that. Don't just read it up and think, oh, I've done that, I've read the books, read the first chapter of the survey, listened to the lecture. No, you've got to make that a living reflection that you bring to everything you do. Another very important right view is karma. Really getting karma inside you. That there's an ethical distribution, an ethical economy to the universe. And that skillful actions have beneficial results for self and other. Unskillful actions have detrimental results for self and other. Really getting hold of that. Really taking responsibility for one's actions. You know, there's so many wrong views around to do with that. I've had so many excuses, and I've done it myself, for unskillful behaviour, rationalised away with pop psychology, sociology, politics, all that kind of stuff. And it's all an avoidance of karmic responsibility, my karmic responsibility. Well, if you want harmony with a spiritual community, that has to be really strong. You know, we have to have that as a conviction, not just as a belief and as an idea, but something deeply thought through, lived through, felt through. But it's more than that. I think it's also, you know, there's the doctrine, there's the teaching, and so on. There's practicing together. I think that really comes up in relation to the shared life, really meditating together, doing puja together. But with the view, the vision, it's also that sense of what Sangha actually describes as that indescribable something that kind of pervades the Triratna Buddhist order. In that interview, What is the Western Buddhist Order? Or What is the Triratna Buddhist Order? It's well worth reading and rereading. You know, he defines what the order is quite closely. But then he says, towards the end, but he said, there is something about me and something about the order and the movement that can't be pinned down and shouldn't be pinned down. It's that indescribable something that kind of hovers over things or within things, that kind of, you know, pervades all of these practices that we do. The practices need to be there, but there's that extra something that we needed to be opening up to. And perhaps you sort of feel it at times. You know, maybe I felt it very vividly sometimes in pujas, order pujas sometimes, this deep sense of harmony. You know, which has got nothing to do with how much I know about people or even the little tiffs I have with them. It's sort of seeing my fellow orders, dharmacharis, dharmacharinis, you know, seeing them much more deeply, I guess. Really having that vital response to their going for refuge. And of course, it's something, in a puja, it's towards something higher. You're meeting in and through that higher dimension. You're sort of lifted up in and through that. It could come, you know, when you're working together strongly for the Dharma, there's that, often that exhilaration you can feel when a group of you are spreading the Dharma. I've had some of my strongest experiences of harmony, unity, closeness, love, when I've been working with order members, teaching the Dharma to others. Remember when I lived in India very, very vividly, you know, with Indian order members, and we'd go around these slums in Bombay doing Dharma talks, and there was this tremendous closeness, you know, that we felt with one another, because we were proclaiming the Dharma together. And I think people really got something from seeing us together. They liked the vibe that we had, you know, between us. I've even been on trains after going for refuge retreats here. I remember one going down to London with some other ordination team members, and we were all in a, you know, round a table together, and we were kind of really enjoying. We'd had a good retreat, you know, we were off, you know, for a bit of fun. Good fun, skillful fun. And we were really kind of happy with one another. And out the corner of my eye, I noticed some people on the next table, and they're kind of looking at us, and you could see they were trying to work out who or what we were. They couldn't quite, you know, work it out. You know, you could almost sort of see. And in the end, they said, yeah, who are you? You know, I said, oh, well, we're Buddhists. Oh, I thought there was something about you. I thought there was something. And it's interesting that you can, that delighting in that comes, you know, through, you know, harmony, through really living and working together, can be a real example. It can be that fourth sight for people. Sangharakshita, you know, it's funny, on some seminars I was on with him, he was being asked, as he often was in those days, all about insight, who's got it, etc., etc. And it gave this amazing answer. He said, yes, I get a lot of letters from people, you know, who expressing a lot of gratitude for, you know, the order and so on. And they always say, yes, the teaching was very good on the retreat they went to, but what really inspired them, what really moved them, was the pleasure with which the order members and the mitras running the team had in one another. The way they worked together, the obvious enjoyment that they had in working together to communicate the Dharma. And the kind of message was clear. Look, this is the real thing. You know, when you really start having a transcendence of self, when you start having a transcendence of self and other, you know, when you drop those barriers, that hardness and harshness, when you soften in relation to others, you know, a number of others, when you come together, you know, and you come together for the benefit of the world, that's when it really starts happening. When that's when the Dharma life really starts happening. When that's when liberation really starts to happen. It can manifest in all kinds of ways. In a silent meditation retreat, it can happen. You can even feel it sometimes on solitary retreat. But the really important thing is that softening to one another for the benefit of the world. There's a great poem, which I'll finish with, of Bhante's. It's called The Golden Flower. It's a poem about friendship in relation to another. But actually, you could see this applying to the whole spiritual community. the golden flower. So love grew up between us like a flower, though neither made sign or breathed a word, content to watch it growing hour by hour, and see its petals by the breezes stirred. At length it grew to such a breadth and height, it stood there like a mighty forest tree, with thousand glorious petals golden bright, and I could not see you, nor you see me. And so the flower, for both, is all in all, though each is in the flower in each, and each in each, forever past recall, a mystery this, beyond the grasp of speech.